Welcome to Talking History. This is your host, Brian Lebeau of Creighton University's Department of History. In today's show, we'll be talking about the history of beer making, or brewing, in medieval England with historian Judith Bennett. So run to the fridge, grab a cold one, settle back, and get ready to learn something about one of your favorite beverages. While you're doing that, let's take a look at an important event that occurred this week in history. During this week in 1882, outlaw Jesse James, a cold-blooded killer to some, a modern-day Robin Hood to others, was killed. At the end of the Civil War, Jesse James and other ex-Confederates living in Missouri began robbing banks and trains. They politicized their crimes as a way to carry on Southern principles against Northern occupation of the South following the war. To do this, James gained the power of the press as a way to publicize his stand against those businesses on behalf of all those citizens who were at their mercy. The brutality of the James gang met its match, however, when most of them were killed during an attempted bank robbery in Northfield, Minnesota. Jesse was forced to recruit less skilled, less disciplined, and less faithful men, two of whom, Robert and Charles Ford, turned on Jesse and killed him in his St. Joseph, Missouri home this week in 1882. Turning to items of historical interest in the news, we've all heard about people who say they have a passion for history. But Russell Ledger of Plattsmith, Nebraska, is intent on making those words a reality for himself and others. Ledger, who repairs vacuum cleaners by day, is a wagon master that has organized numerous wagon trips throughout the United States. Riding along historic American trails, like the Oregon Trail and the California Gold Rush Trail, Ledger's entourage usually consists of 5 to 7 riders, all with a considerable love for the outdoors and insistence on historical accuracy. When asked what passengers do when they need to go to the bathroom, for example, Ledger's response is quite simple. We do exactly what they did in the Old West, men to the left of the wagons and women to the right. In the future, Ledger hopes to organize a wagon trip from Connecticut to Ohio in commemoration of Ohio's bicentennial, as well as a journey across the trails that African American slaves took when fleeing from Kentucky to Kansas. The two Democratic presidential contenders are not the only leaders calling for removal of the Confederate flag from the Capitol building in South Carolina. Dorsey Henderson, the Episcopal Bishop of Columbia, South Carolina, believes that while the flag may be a symbol of pride and heritage to many people, such a blatant reminder of racial tension should not be displayed on top of a Capitol building. Growing up in a small town in South Carolina, Henderson remembers why the battle flag was erected in the first place. As the civil rights movement began gaining momentum throughout the South, political leaders chose the flag to represent the state's defiance of change. In a recent act of support for the NAACP's boycott of state services and facilities, Bishop Henderson shortened the annual convention of Episcopal Church members so that delegates and visitors would not be forced to spend the night in a South Carolina hotel. You're listening to Talking History. The brewing and marketing of ale and beer are largely male enterprises today, as is its consumption, if one's to judge by the images of popular culture. We're about to learn, however, that that has not always been the case. Once upon a time, as they say, brewing was woman's work. And here to tell us more about that and why things changed is Judith Bennett, professor of history at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, and the author of a great new book, Ale, Beer, and Brewsters in England, Woman's Work in a Changing World, 1300 to 1600, published by Oxford University Press. Welcome, Professor Bennett.
Thank you.
And thank you for joining us. As the title suggests, this is more than just a history of brewing beer in medieval England. It's a social history as well, but maybe we should start with the first part of your story, and maybe even with the title, the term brewsters. Sounds like brewers, but it isn't quite the same, and it's likely to be unfamiliar to most of us. So what does it mean, and what are the origins of that term?
The ending stirrer is a feminine ending in Middle English, just like today we talk about waitresses and actresses. In Middle English, stir indicated a female occupation, and so a brewster is a female brewer. The terms mostly survive in modern English in surnames, so a Webster is a female weaver, Baxter a female baker, and Brewster a female brewer.
So this suggests the considerable involvement of women then in the brewing of beer.
That's right. In fact, in medieval England, a lot of regulations don't talk about brewers at all. They talk about brewsters, which suggests that in the minds of the mayors and aldermen putting out these regulations, that almost all people in the brewing industry were, in fact, women.
Okay, let's pursue that a bit. In your book, you indicate that at least prior to 1350, the brewing of beer, ale and beer, was largely woman's work, thus the word brewsters. How did that come about and why?
It came about because beer brewing initially was domestic labor. Women brewed it to provide ale for their families to consume. It was a critical part of the English diet. Ale and bread were the two essential parts of the diet. And so women, as good wives, would brew ale for their families to consume. And if they had extra left over, they would sell it to their neighbors. So it began as women's household work, and then slowly, as it became commercialized, it grew out of the household.
Okay, so first ale, beer came a little later, and first in the home for home consumption, and then a bit sold outside the home.
That's right.
Okay, well, what happened after 1350 to change that?
Well, first of all, let me just say that before 1350, if we lived in a village before 1350, almost all women would sometimes sell a little bit of ale out of their houses. So it was a very widespread and dispersed trade. If we lived in a village of 100 households, almost all of them would occasionally have women in them selling ale. After 1350, the trade becomes much more specialized. In say, that village of 100 people, there might just be a half dozen people selling ale. That happens for a whole variety of complex reasons. Obviously, what happens around 1350 is the Great Plague, which sweeps through England 1347-49 and kills perhaps a third of the population, is our best estimate. So there are fewer people in England after 1350, but they drink a lot more ale. The standards of living rise, the diet changes, they drink more ale, they drink better quality ale. They also tend to drink it much more in ale houses as opposed to taking it home, and it's much more profitable to sell ale within ale houses. And so as demand for ale rises, it becomes a more profitable industry, and slowly men become interested in it as well, and slowly they begin to encroach on what had been a women's trade.
So as it becomes more commercial, it becomes more attractive to men for the possibility of making profit and so on.
That's right. It's a much more profitable trade after 1350 than it had been before.
Did you note any resistance on the part of women to this? Was there any conflict in this changeover between the sexes?
There's absolutely no evidence of resistance on this score. But, of course, our records are very limited. I think we can't say there was resistance or that there wasn't. The sort of resistance that would have happened would have been, you know, an argument in the street between a brewster and a brewer, that sort of thing. There are no records of something like that.
You note that by 1600, most brewers are male, but earlier you suggest in the 15th century, we find that women are actually doing some brewing but hiding behind their husband's sort of public persona. Why was this the case?
Well, let me just say the withdrawal of women from brewing happens for different sorts of women at different times. So the first women who tend to leave the trade are women who don't have husbands, women who are what we would today probably call spinsters, but were then called single women, women who had never married, begin to leave the trade after 1350, and also widows. So women without full households, in a sense, without husbands and husbands' labor help and capital, leave the trade earlier. Slowly, wives also, as you say, began to hide their trading behind their husbands, and there are a variety of reasons for that. One is that the people who regulated the trade preferred to deal with husbands than with wives, because under the systems of law then in place, men were more legally liable than women, and so if you had a brewing household doing something wrong, it was easier to bring it to account if you could deal with the husband rather than the wife. So it became convenient in terms of regulation and public presentation of the business to have the husband as the responsible person.
Okay. Well, let me take you back to a point you sort of hinted at earlier when you mentioned the plague. When we talk about the brewing of beer here, we're not just simply talking about a tavern drink, although that's certainly part of it, or something for socializing. You make the point in your book that beer is really quite central to the English diet during the Middle Ages. Explain that a bit for us.
I'll have to answer that in two ways. First of all, and we've alluded to this earlier, but I should clarify, there's a distinction in this period between ale and beer. And ale is made without hops. We don't drink anything related to medieval ale now at all. Beer is made with hops. Ale is the earlier drink, and it is absolutely essential to the English diet through the Middle Ages. There are only two commodities, food products that are strictly regulated in the Middle Ages. One is bread, which is very obvious to us as an essential part of the human diet, but the other is ale. And it was regulated because it was the essential liquid refreshment for everyone. Wine was too expensive for anyone but the very wealthy to consume. Milk was mostly made into cheese. And water was usually polluted and considered unhealthy to drink. And so the brewing of ale, which involved boiling water, made it a healthier drink. And everyone drank ale all the time. Children drank it. Old people drank it. They drank it at breakfast, at lunch, and at dinner. I should say that the strengths varied enormously. And so the everyday ale that people drank was not going to make them drunk or lead to inebriation. It was just the standard drink.
Was consumption a class matter, or did we find that upper classes drank beer as well as wine?
Yes. In an elite household, they would actually, we have very good dietary accounts for some elite households, and they would drink ale, again, at breakfast, at lunch, at dinner, but also supplement it when they could get it with wine.
And women then would consume their fair share as well as men?
Yes. And a lot of ale was consumed every day. We have records of the amount of ale that was needed for armies, and we know from that. And also, actually, we have some records that suggest the average daily consumption in monasteries. And I think it's fair to say that in, say, 1300, the average adult male consumption of ale per day was a gallon of ale. A lot of ale.
That is, yeah. Well, just for the record, correct my earlier reference, when did beer come on the scene?
Beer isn't brewed in England until the early 15th century. It's imported into England earlier, but it's mostly, until really well into the 15th century, it's seen as a foreign drink. And actually there's some interesting nationalistic literature about how ale is a good English drink and beer is a foreign Dutch drink that the English shouldn't drink and so on.
Oh, so its origins, at least as far as the English were concerned, was that it came from Holland, from the Dutch?
Well, the term Dutch in that period sort of generically referred to areas that we today would call the Netherlands and Belgium and also various German principalities.
Okay. You talk in your book a bit about the importance of beer in a political sense. Tell me a little bit about regulation, taxes, and so on.
Beer, like bread, beer and bread were regulated at the national level very, very early. There are even some regulations that date back to the Anglo-Saxon period. The critical regulation is from the 13th century. It's called the Assize of Ale and Beer, and it basically commands authorities at the local level, either manorial officials or town officials, to regulate the way in which ale and beer are sold, to make sure that it's good quality stuff, that it's sold at proper measure, and also that it's sold at reasonable prices. That regulation really operates at two levels of motivation. One is that making sure that a supply of ale and bread was always available was very important in terms of social harmony. When ale is too expensive or not available, or the same with bread, you're likely to have people in the streets causing trouble. So that's the first motivation for regulation. The second is purely fiscal, making money. because the regulation of the trade generated income for whoever regulated it, because you could make brewers and also bakers pay fees to be licensed to pursue the trade.
Well, knowing the trade a bit, I don't think I'd apply for the tax collecting job, but the tasting job you mentioned sounds pretty good. I might take that one.
That's right. The way local regulation operated usually is that there was an officer called an ale taster who was responsible for going round to any household that had ale to sell, and it was his job, it was always a man, to taste the ale and therefore determine how alcoholic it was and therefore determine its price. And also determine whether it was healthy. It sounds like a great job, but we do have records actually about the problems ale tasters had, that they sometimes got ill from tasting the ale, and also sometimes they got into pretty nasty fights with brewers and brewsters.
Well, maybe I won't take the job after all. Now, these changes that you talk about don't take place in a vacuum. You have a larger history of transformation going on here that you talk about in your book. How does all this fit into the general scheme of history in this time period?
Well, the transformation of brewing from the small-scale, domestic, localized industry into what it is, which is what it was really in 1300, to the way it looks in 1600 when it's a very sophisticated industry, highly capitalized, very professionalized. Really, brewing has some of the earliest what you might call proto-factories in England. You have these huge brew houses along the Thames in London that employ dozens of people and produce huge amounts of ale or beer by the end of the 16th century. That change in brewing is, in a sense, a classic example of what we often call the commercial revolution, a more capitalized, more industrialized, more professionalized business. So in that sense, brewing is a classic example. What I argue in the book, though, is that if you look at it from the point of view of women, it suggests that although there are enormous economic and social changes happening in this period, not a great deal changes for women.
So that's
brewing changes.
Okay.
Women's status in the trade, I argue, doesn't change very much at all.
So that's your reference then to considerable change and yet continuities at the same time.
That's right.
Things like urbanization and rising per capita income and all of these other factors play into it strongly as well.
Yes, absolutely. For example, urbanization creates much larger markets that are much easier to reach, which means that you can brew larger amounts of ale and beer and market it much more efficiently and quickly, which again leads to a more profitable industry.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned the development of alehouses as well rather quickly here because we're getting near the end of our time. Is this where we can look to the beginnings of these kinds of social places largely for men?
Alehouses were not largely for men in the Middle Ages.
Uh-huh.
They are largely for men in the 19th century, for example. There are a lot of organizations that are largely for men, though, in the Middle Ages. So I might look to other places, for example, to the social gatherings associated with medieval trade guilds.
Okay. Let me just wind it up with and let you respond to one of your quotes here, because I found it a good one. You say that you set out to investigate, quote, what English people thought about brewsters and how their ideas might have affected the ability of women to compete with men in the trade. It seems to be central to what you're writing about. How would you summarize what you found in that search?
Well, in the book I looked at a lot of sort of classic historical factors, that economic change and how that affected women, and that changes in regulation, how that affected women, and so on. What I set out to do when I looked at how people thought about brewsters was, in a sense, to think about cultural causes in terms of women leaving the trade. And what I found is that there were very, very negative associations attached to female brewers, to brewsters, that were not attached to male brewers. And I examined those and concluded that, in fact, I think that in this case, words do hurt, and that it was one of the factors that encouraged, that harmed women insofar as they were competing with men for this trade.
this is a story we could pursue for perhaps a whole other show sometime. This is a not uncommon explanation of what happens in study of gender and history.
Yes, I think that's right. But it's very hard to nail down. You can look at things like economic changes, as I do in the book, and have tables and so on. But when you're talking about ideas, it's much harder to prove cause and effect.
Great. Well, we'll have to end it there. Thank you for joining us, Professor Bennett.
No, thank you.
You've been listening to Judith Bennett, Professor of History at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill and the author of Ale, Beer, and Brewsters in England, Woman's Work in a Changing World, 1300 to 1600, published by Oxford University Press. And this is Talking History. Related to our discussion on the history of beer is the following op-ed on prohibition, not on its causes and even its impact on law and order, but rather on gender, the public consumption of alcohol by both men and women. Here to tell us about it is Catherine Murdoch, who has taught history at Bryn Mawr College and is the author of Domesticating Drink, Women, Men, and Alcohol in America, 1870 to 1940.
Throughout the 1800s, women battled demon Rome. They worried incessantly about men going off together into saloons, drinking up their wages, possibly in the company of prostitutes, and going home to beat their wives and starve their children. And this scenario did happen, enough that women supported prohibition much more avidly than men did. Which is not to say that women never drank. Almost every cookbook from the 19th century described how to make wine and cordials and punch, or cocktails. Etiquette manuals instructed women how to serve and drink champagne and sherry. The expectation, however, was that women would drink small amounts of feminine beverages in very private settings. Then prohibition went into effect in 1920. It hit the country at the same time as a number of other upheavals. Women during the 1920s worked for wages in unprecedented numbers. They smoked, bobbed their hair, raised their hemlines, tossed out their corsets. They voted. All acts seen as immensely daring and also immensely liberating. Plus, there was a great new emphasis on companionate marriage. You no longer simply married your spouse. You married your best friend. And because birth control was now more and more common, you could enjoy the company of your best friend long before marriage itself. And so, to the horror of all the well-meaning ladies who had just gotten prohibition enacted, women, especially young women, drank. And not just at home, but in public and speakeasies, at football games. And not just prim, prissy little cordials, but cocktails, whiskey, gin, manly drinks, drunk with men, behavior that a generation earlier would have been solely for prostitutes. Prohibition was repealed in 1933, and the uniform belief from 1933 until today is that it was a huge mistake, a travesty. Perhaps it was. But prohibition has two crucial legacies. The first is that it ended the saloon for good, and with it all of the saloon's disturbing associations with corruption and crime and alcoholism and venereal disease. There are still bars, of course. But now there are package stores, or state stores as we call them here in Pennsylvania, where you buy a sealed bottle of alcohol to drink elsewhere, assumedly at home. Prohibition's second legacy relates to this. Before Prohibition, men drank with men. Since Prohibition, men, at home and in public, are far more likely to drink with women. Prohibition, like it or not, ungendered alcohol.
You've been listening to Catherine Murdoch, author of Domesticating Drink, Women, Men, and Alcohol in America, 1870 to 1940.
No, I don't drink it no more. I'm tired of making up on the floor. No, thank you, please. It only makes me sneeze. Baby, it makes it hard to finally go. Well, I said, no, 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 no. I can't take it no more.
For our our site of the week, we continue our discussion of the early history of beer by calling to your attention a museum dedicated to that same subject. Here to tell you more about it is Talking History's Cindy Workman.
The Brewers Museum in Brussels, Belgium is a wonderful place to visit. You'll see the old kettles boiling, fermentation tubs, and materials found in an 18th century brewery. Old tankards, antique porcelain, and paraphernalia from an inn of the past illustrate what many call the Belgian beer culture. But here, you'll see not only the brewing techniques of the past, but today's technology as well. It costs about $3 for the tour, and you're rewarded with a beer at the cafe at the end of the walk. So next time you're in Brussels, don't miss the Brewers Museum.
And finally, turning to our weekly segment, Coming Attractions, April 10th through the 13th is U.S. Marshals Week, or at least it is for the History Channel. It will premiere a four-part miniseries on the U.S. Marshals Service, the oldest law enforcement agency in America. The Marshals have played important roles in many famous events in American history, from the Whiskey Rebellion of 1784 to the Gangland Wars of the Prohibition era, from the desegregation of the South to the tracking down of drug traffickers in the 1990s. This four-part series, airing each night from April 10th through the 13th, recounts the exploits of these often unsung federal lawmen. Also on April 10th, tune in the History Channel's program, Terror in the Heartland, The Black Legion. They saw themselves as the guardians of white Christian values, but this secret organization with a membership of over 130,000 was responsible for at least 57 murders in the 1930s. Who were they? How did such a group form? How was it finally brought to justice? Find the answers to all these questions and more in Terror in the Heartland, which airs on the History Channel on April 10th. Be sure to check your local listings for exact times for both of these programs. And that's it for another week of Talking History. I hope you've enjoyed our program and that you will join us next week when we'll take a look at some history behind the news, in this case, the history of Austria's recently elected Freedom Party and its supposed Nazi past. In the meantime, we invite you to send us your comments or suggestions either by email at talkinghistory@creighton.edu or by U.S. mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History at Creighton University in Omaha, Nebraska, 68178. Until next time, from the studios of KIOS-FM in Omaha, Nebraska, this is Brian LeBeau.